Hello, my name's Jamie Gordon.
And I'm Ginny Carlin.
And this is the BFBS podcast, Mav Geeks, a military aircraft obsession.
Thank you for joining us. If this is your first time and you're not sure if you'll like all the av talk and you're a little bit apprehensive, do not worry. We do have a safe word.
Unfortunately, neither of us know what it is. It used to be planes, but that kind of didn't work.
I mean, to be fair, there is no end to the aircraft talk. You know that. I know that. We didn't choose the Mav Life. The Mav Life chose us. Anyway, Jamie, how's your week been?
Very interesting, actually. Quick word about this air show in China, which we briefly spoke about last week, because the Su-57, which is the new Russian stealth jet, was being shown off. Well, this time around, now that the air show is on, they've been looking at the J-35A, which is the new Chinese stealth aircraft. And it looks remarkably like an F-35. And here he is scratching his chin, thinking, how much espionage has been going on over the years for them to come up with a jet that looks so very similar to something we have? And of course, you know, a cynic might say it came about that way, but arguably all these stealth aircraft, they all aim to do the same thing invariably. And it kind of makes sense that they end up all looking pretty much the same. But it's been quite fascinating. Watch that flying around. So all sorts of going on there. But the Red Arrows have had big news this week. Have you heard?
Only very slightly. I didn't hear the I don't want to give it away. I've heard a little bit, shall we say.
Yeah, they've got two new members of the team, a new Red 2 and a new Red 3. Red 2 is Flight Lieutenant Rob Thomas, who has qualified on Hawk, of course, and went through to go on Typhoons and flew operationally there, doing QRA at Conning. Etc. The new Red 3 had a slightly less conventional route through to fast jets, and that's Flight Lieutenant Andrew McEwen. And there was a break in his pilot training in the RAF, and he thought, with a mate, I know what we're going to do. Let's go and join the Navy for a couple of years. And that's exactly what they did. So he got his qualifications as the officer of the watch and got all his naval navigational watchkeeping certificates, and then ended up driving ships for a couple of years. He went on Illustrious. He drove Type 45s, Dauntless, wow, and Dragon. And then he just went back to, you know, I think I'll do a bit more flying then. And he ended up on the F-35 and is now Red 3. So an overachiever if ever there was one.
I mean, two things of note there. Rob Thomas, I'm pretty sure, also sang Smooth with Santana.
He's a talented lad.
He's a talented boy. And you were saying that the incoming Red 3 that joined the Navy. I mean, what does his LinkedIn profile look like? What does his resume look like? He's done everything. All he needs to do now is get in a tank, and he's done the trifecta, the holy trinity of militariness. So I take my hat off to him.
And who's to say he won't do that after he's done his tour with the Reds? Anything interesting this week?
Well, just to say that we obviously spoke to a guy called Russ this week for this podcast, who was a door gunner in Iraq and Afghanistan. I can't stop thinking about that because it was just so lovely, and I can't wait for us to bring that in the coming weeks. But also, I don't know if you've read about this with Spirit Airlines now. Unfortunately, Spirit Airlines, I think in the last few days, have gone into like liquidation. But before that, Spirit Airlines, I think it was an A320 coming into land at Haiti, somebody started shooting at it. The inside of the cabin, all like where the overhead luggage bins are, all shot up. Luckily, nobody seriously hurt. The pilot noped his way out of there, like, nope. I'm just going to get out. We're not landing here. And now, you know, all American flights have been suspended to Haiti. But it did sort of, something made me, obviously not that made me chuckle, but something made me chuckle that came out of that was that somebody had done an AI meme of the new Spirit paint scheme. It was all in camouflage, and on the side where, you know, where the door is, where you go in, they'd actually put like a door gunner. So it reminded me of us speaking to Russ. Obviously, it was just AI, but it kind of took my eye. You know what I mean?
Terrifying experience for all of those involved. But well done to the pilot for getting them all out. So today, our guest is a former Hercules pilot and a former 747 pilot and a current aviator, TV producer, and a Times best-selling author. What can't he do?
He also has a large online aviation following, which I am part of, fellow Mav Geeks. Earlier this year, Jamie and I spoke to Scott Bateman, MBE, and it was glorious.
Glorious. Can we start at the beginning? Because the book, Hercules, details the airframe, your connection with it, and we'll come to that in due course. But I'm keen to know where it all started. Was there aviation in the blood, in the family? You're from a part of Scotland I quite know well, which has got a lot of aviation to it. So how did it all begin?
Well, I think it was my dad, really. So, as you say, I lived in Scotland, just outside Dundee, in a small village called Auchterarts. And every day, we were zapped across by phantoms back then and lightnings from Lucas. Every time I looked up, I saw aeroplanes, and I just wanted to do that. I just wanted to be an RAF pilot. And then when I was about 13, I went to the RAF Lucas at Home Day with my dad. It was the turning point. That was it. I was sold. Joined the Air Cadets in Dundee, had an amazing foundation from them, which set me up for a career in the RAF, firstly as an air loadmaster on the C-130, and then latterly as a pilot on the C-130 and the Islander.
So you talked about these amazing things, but was it always the C-130 that took your eye and that you wanted to fly on?
No, I'll admit it. And people who know me now will absolutely go mad at this, but I wanted to be on helicopters. RAF Lucas had, at the time, a Wessex search and rescue helicopter. And that was it. I wanted to rescue people in the Highlands. I wanted to be that person. And when I became a loadmaster, I thought, right, if I can't fly the Hercules, I want to be a crewman on search and rescue. People who know me now will go mental over this, because actually I have such an aversion to helicopters now, you wouldn't believe it. But back then, I was young and stupid and didn't know any better. And helicopters were what I wanted to do. And the Hercules thing came up, as you'll find out in the book, almost by accident due to the Gulf War and competing priorities through the Gulf War. I started off as being streamed to go to Chinooks because they needed crewmen for Chinooks out in the desert. And then there was a change of priorities, and I ended up going to the C-130 with a friend of mine.
No, I was just going to say that I know after reading your feeds on social media that it's like a really hard no when anybody ever mentions a helicopter. So I was really quite surprised when you said the helicopter.
I think a hard no would be an understatement, Ginny. It's just there is no way you'd get me anywhere near one now. But never say never.
You ended up joining 47 Squadron, which is arguably the most famous Hercules squadron of all time in the RAF. And you very fondly mention it throughout the book. Just tell us a bit about the history of that squadron and why it was so special to those who served in it.
47 Squadron, and I was very fortunate enough to serve there in three capacities, as a loadmaster to begin with, a co-pilot, then a captain. I think it's a very special squadron because its history means it's the only squadron in the RAF ever to have fought under its own flag. And people will see these people walking around, well, not now because the squadron's been disbanded, sadly, for the time being. But anyone who's seen a 47 Squadron member will see that they wear a blue, yellow and red flag on their shoulder. And you think, well, why are they not wearing the Union Jack or something like that? Well, the squadron was very fortunate in during the time of the Russian Revolution. They were sent to fight, and they were sent to fight because of the political sensitivities fighting in that war. They couldn't fight using the Union Jack, because we weren't going to be involved in that war. So 47 Squadron was kind of disbanded. It became something called A Flight, using that flag, which was originally red, white and blue, cunning colours, but actually got a bit faded and ended up becoming red, yellow and blue. That's kind of what bonds the squadron together, is that flag. And they had such an amazing history, which, you know, Khartoum features very highly in the history of the squadron. And actually the last operational sortie, it was actually to Khartoum. And, you know, so the squadron actually came full circle. The Nile is the source of its strength, is the Latin across the bottom of the 47 Squadron badge. And the badge has a damozel crane with the red, the white and the blue Nile depicted behind the damozel crane. So Khartoum, Sudan, has played a massive part in the squadron's history. And in 2023... what happened? The last mission, at the 11th hour, the C-130 was given a little bit of a reprieve, and it was sent in with some 47 Squadron crews into Khartoum to rescue people from the ongoing conflict there. And that was the last operational mission for the squadron and for the aircraft. So a bit of synergy there of it going full circle, which was lovely. I think from a kid, I think I always wanted to be a pilot. And when I went into selection in Biggin Hill, it was back then, kind of dating myself there a little. When I went to Biggin Hill, they quite rightly said, you're too immature. You know, you're not mature enough to be a pilot. I was really young. And I was a young 18, 19-year-old as well. You know, I'd come from Scotland, a rural area of Scotland, not very worldly wise. Actually going to Biggin Hill for selection was one of the biggest adventures I'd ever done in my life. You know, one of the biggest journeys I'd ever done on my own. So when you look back, actually, they were right. I wasn't ready to be a pilot. And then when I got in, it just fueled my passion more. And I thought, right, I just really need to get in the right-hand seat of a Hercules was all I wanted to get in then, because the Hercules had sort of kind of had become my passion at that point. And I thought, right, I am going to fly this plane. And I eventually did.
When you came to fly in anger, did the fact that you had that experience in the back help, hinder, or what?
Good question. I think it helped me. It probably hindered some of the loadmasters, because actually, as a loadmaster, you're always trying to think, you know, kind of hoodwink them into believing that everything's all right down the back. But when you've got a co-pilot or captain who actually knows what should be right down the back, that can often be an issue. But no, I came back. I loved coming back. I went back to the same squadron, and all my people who had been my peers were now part of the crews that I flew around and eventually managed as a captain. I never once came across any issues with it. And actually, I think it did help, because you have an understanding of what they're trying to achieve and what the crew is trying to achieve. But as I say, sometimes it was a hindrance, because you think, oh, well, I could just muck in and help them. And actually, they really don't want your help.
Yeah.
They want you to stick in your own lane, Scott. Yeah.
I mean, what an absolute shame that we aren't flying anymore. So, Scott, I'm sure that you know a lady who's now a padre. We had her on one of the episodes. Her name is Alice. She was a C-130 pilot.
Yeah. I flew with Ali a number of times. Number of times.
Ah, see,
I can
right, okay.
Think of a famous story when Ali and I went to Cape Canaveral, actually. But I'm not going to tell that story, because Ali's now a padre and not a pilot. So telling stories about the padre might get me smite by thunder and lightning or something. So I'm not going to tell stories about Ali. But I have flown with Ali on a number of occasions, because Ali herself served on 47 Squadron as a captain back in the day. So before she became a padre, I was on a trip with Ali where Ali was the captain. This shows stereotyping. We actually landed somewhere in the US and they came up to me and they said, "Captain, how would you like stuff done?" I went, "She's a captain."
So one of the things Alice was saying to us when we interviewed her was, it was around the time when the last Hercules were being retired. That's when we spoke to her. And she's telling us some of the stories about that. And I was just about to say to you about how old she said it was inside the C-130, that it actually had an ashtray. And she was saying about landing in some hostile, dusty place, and the Americans had come out and said, "Oh, you need to leave your onboard computer on." And she's laughing and she said, "Well, what onboard computer would that be?" But she spoke about the aircraft with such great affection. Have you got any stories like that? Just, I mean, I always think the inside of a C-17 must be, well, I mean, I've seen the inside of a C-17. I know it's more like a Land Rover Defender, built for substance over style.
Yeah, I think that the K model was a bit like an old Defender. I think you're right. It was rugged and reliable and probably the most forgiving aeroplane I think I've ever flown. It was such a lovely aeroplane to do stuff, but it was a bit Heath Robinson. And I think, you know, all of the stuff, if we go back to even the refueling probe, a good story here about the refueling probe. So the refueling probe was literally stuck on the roof. I mean, this is not a lie. We're during the Falklands War. They said, "We need to refuel to get down to the Falkland Islands. How are we going to do that?" And they literally stuck this thing on the roof, put a bit of coaming over it, stuck the pipe down into the main tanks and put an extra pump in. I mean, nowadays, that would take 25 years of CAD design. They would have to trial it. They did it all in 2 afternoons. They designed that system in 2 afternoons. So it was one of those things that, you know, aftermarket additions were done all the time to make just to make the job do and to get on with stuff. In terms of a story for me, oh goodness, I've got so many. I think one of the best stories for me is I came out of Kabul once carrying the heaviest load that I think I've ever carried, which was an armored JCB. And the loadmasters had loaded this JCB on board, and we were going to take it from Kabul down to a strip somewhere where they were going to do a little bit of construction. And we got airborne with this JCB, and the airplane just didn't climb. It just did not want to climb. And eventually, it was the curvature of the earth. We pulled this thing away. We climbed around, went and landed at this strip, took off the JCB. Loadmaster was actually scratching his head, couldn't figure out what the problem was. And he says, I just don't understand. He says, you know, we've got the weights for all of this. We've done it, blah, blah, blah. And it was the navigator who looked. And we used to get these for big loads. They used to have like a little plan on how to put the thing in the aeroplane and how to tie it all down to make sure it was secure. And all these things were done in advance so that if you were ever going to carry the armored JCB, you just pulled out the plan for the armored JCB and you knew how to put it in. And the nav goes, where's the bucket? I beg your pardon? He says, where's the bucket on this plan? He says, we've just carried this thing with a bucket on the front. And he went, how's it? And the bucket was 3.5 tons. And 3.5 tons overweight because the bucket was attached to the JCB.
Oh, what?
And it wasn't on the picture. And nobody had noticed that on this picture, you had to carry the bucket separately, which is absolutely ludicrous because what are you going to do with a JCB without the bucket? But it was so heavy that you couldn't carry the bucket and we just didn't notice. And that's how forgiving the C-130 was. 3.5 tons overweight. And guess what? It got airborne and it did the job.
One of my favourite quotes from the book, and I'm going to attribute it to you in the first instance, but you write, the lump of aluminium that binds us all together, which I thought was quite prophetic, but true for an aeroplane that, as you've just described, was you could adapt it and adapt it and adapt it, and it would still do it.
Yeah, and I think that's... you're right. It seems a bit odd, doesn't it, that we all have this affection for a lump of aluminium. And we really do. You know, you can see it's on my walls here. I've got models of it. I have a real love for this aeroplane. And I think that sounds, you know, to somebody who's not flown it or not had a relationship with this aeroplane, they won't understand it. But this aeroplane has saved me. It's taken me to war. It's brought me back from war. It's saved lives. And sadly, you know, we've lost some friends. But when we haven't been able to, you know, bring the aeroplane back. But in the main, we have this amazing relationship with this lump of metal that really looks after us. The 70th anniversary this year of this aeroplane, it's the longest production run of any military aeroplane ever. And I think that just shows how successful it's been. And still having deliveries. The Luftwaffe will receive, I think, 10 deliveries in 2024 of the new C-130J.
If you have a look at flight radar, you can see, just as you said, so many different nationalities there that are flying the C-130, and we don't.
I think it was a decision that was made politically based on cost, because the C-130Js had a hard life. I think their original plan for the C-130J was for it to be in service for 35 years, but that was based on a balance of some operations and some peacetime ops. But if you look at the life the C-130J had, really, it came into service in 1999, 2000, and ever since then, we've been involved in wars, you know, and it's had a real hard life in the desert and beyond, and has constantly been on operations for its entire time in the Air Force. So it's been battered, you know, and it needed a bit of work doing on it, which was going to cost a significant amount of money. And the government weren't willing to pay that. And, you know, whether that's the right decision or not is still up for debate. I think it was the wrong decision. I think we should have paid the money and kept at least a small fleet of them for contingencies. The problem that we have now, and you'll hear this mantra about the A400M, that we can go further, faster, with more freight. Well, they can't. And I don't deny that. That is correct. You know, the A400M as a strategic airlift asset is amazing. It can go further, faster with more freight. But I can't deliver four guys to the middle of the Atlantic with boats and drop them off to, you know, an ocean liner which has come under a bomb threat, you know, which is a story that is in the book. You know, we don't have the capability to do that today. Will we in the future? I'm sure we will. But I think for me, gapping some key capabilities by taking the C-130 out of service a little bit early has left the country exposed to some threats that it may not be able to counter.
And some would argue that, you know, it's not just the C-130 that's fallen victim to that kind of decision. I just wanted to go back to the book and the format of it. Not only does it describe your journey with the aircraft, but also you highlight important chapters in the RAF's use of it. But this wouldn't be Mav Geeks if we didn't talk about a bit of spotting on my part anyway. And this was when you did a simulated carrier landing. How the hell does that work?
So you can, famous story, as I'm sure you knew, they landed a C-130 on the USS Forrestal, not once, but 22 times, right? They landed a C-130 on an aircraft carrier. This was an amazing feat. And actually, one of the most amazing facts about the C-130 was in this particular chapter. And it was one of those ones that I thought was a typo. I was absolutely astounded when I heard it, that the C-130, when it landed on the carrier, managed to stop quicker than an F-18 being stopped by the arrestor gear. So it was something like 25 feet shorter than an F-18 being arrested landing on the carrier, the C-130 managed to stop.
Wow.
That's a 50-ton aeroplane landing on a carrier without arrestor gear. I mean, that was phenomenal. And I had a little go of that in the C-130G simulator, which you could do. And, oh my goodness, it's good fun. It's not something that you would do for real, but actually in the sim, it was always when you were having a bit of fun at the end of a detail, it was something that everybody wanted to try. But there's always that pride of, I can do this, I can do this, I can do this. And, oh my goodness, yeah, I almost got caught out, didn't I? So I won't give it away, but I almost got caught out at the 11th hour on that particular little sortie, and we managed to pull it back. But it was a lot of fun doing that. Yeah, but the USS Forrestal story was just amazing.
Now, the book is obviously a massive labour of love for you, a kind of a love sonnet to the C-130. Did you always know that you were going to write that book?
Not at all. Like most of the stories in the book, all good missions start over a beer and an idea. And actually, this particular thing did start over a beer and an idea with John Nicol, whose books are on my shelf back here in the RAF Club. I asked John at the time what he was writing, and back then he was writing Jekt Eject, which hadn't come out yet, his latest book. And he said, you know, you must do one about the Hercules. You know, it would be great. It would be great. And I'm like, no. And we were sitting with a mutual friend of ours who's a police officer who had just written a book called Fabulous Finn, which was about a police dog who had saved its handler and the dog ended up being stabbed, and an apocryphal story. And actually, Finn's Law came in to protect service animals, you may recall. So Dave, who was the handler of that dog, was a mutual friend of ours. And he said, oh, don't worry, Scott. He says, I know somebody who could help you write it. I said, I can't speak English on most days. How am I going to write English? So I met this amazing lady who turns my Scottish ramblings into readable English and helped me form the book, and that was how it started. So every good story starts with a beer, you know, watch this. And actually, that's how it started. So you can blame John Nicol for all of this.
And we blame him for an awful lot more than that. But anyway, but I just wanted to put another quote in here, because I think one of your bosses says, the Hercules is not just an airframe, but it's a way of life, which is a nice way of putting it and a nice way to sort of finish off reflections of that aircraft. But what are you doing now? What keeps you motivated these days, and what are you flying?
So I'm still flying. Sadly, not flying at the moment because I've done my wrists in. But I fly an Airbus for a large UK airline. I'm having a great time doing that, but the most of my time is taken up by aviation television and writing books. And so, you know, I've got a couple of shows at the moment. Air Force One, The Flying Fortress is on Disney Plus. The Last 747 is on Paramount Plus on the Smithsonian Channel in the US. So I've got lots of media stuff ongoing, which is fantastic. And I manage to occasionally go flying in an Airbus. But more books to come, hopefully. The next one's already on the way.
Okay, can you not say too much at this time? Or
oh no, it's my second. Well, no, actually, I've got to be careful. It's my third love, because obviously my wife was my first love.
Obviously.
The Hercules was my second. And if you follow me on Twitter, I'm sure you'll be able to figure out what my third love is. And it's not helicopters, Ginny, before you. I'm not doing a book about the Chinook. Someone else has done that. Liz McConaughey has done a great book about the Chinook. Read that one. But my next book is going to be about my third love, which it might be sitting on my shelf over here as well.
Nah, can't see.
I was going to ask you, you went to Seattle for The Last 747.
Go on.
Rolling off the production line, didn't you?
I did. I did a television program about it. Yeah, so I have a great passion for that aeroplane. Yeah, and that aeroplane is going to feature highly in my life for the next couple of years, despite having stopped flying it in 2019.
Yeah, we had Al Bridger from British Airways, who had just been over at the same time to see that Last 747 off the production line.
Al, I used to work with Al.
Yeah, I went in the BA simulator with Al on the 777. It was fabulous. I ran all over the Heathrow grass, which was great. And he would just like literally show me what to do. I'd get on with it. I don't think I was particularly good at it, but he was such a good cheerleader. And I would love to fly, but there's a reason that I don't. But yeah, Alan just got in from Seattle the day before. He'd been there. I'm sure you probably saw him out there, but he was talking about it, and I asked him the question when we interviewed him about how he felt about the 7-4 and also about how he felt about it like being the end of the line, basically, because obviously he was there. Well, he was the one that did the final flight of the BA 747 from Heathrow. He was saying that the Queen of the Sky will always be that special plane for him, but kind of looking forward, obviously that aircraft's still going to continue in some ways, but looking forward, you know, that's the only way that you can look, really. Great affection for the Queen of the Skies, but there's much, much more to come from other aviation technology.
Yeah, I think that day was bittersweet for all of us. And, you know, we sat in a hangar with 10,000 people and were greeted by John Travolta, who waxed lyrical about his time on the 747. And, you know, I don't mind admitting it, it was a teary moment. And, you know, it really was. And we heard all this amazing story of how the aeroplane had literally changed the world. And then the doors opened to the hangar and there was the last one. That's it, done. You know, 52 and a half, 53 years of production, 1,574 aeroplanes and done. An empty hangar, no more jumbos. And actually for Seattle as a whole, and I mean the city, the entire city, that's a big deal, you know. That really is a big deal. You know, that aeroplane framed that city for half a century plus. So, you know, I know we're going off on it's a non-Hercules tangent, but it really, you know, made a huge impact globally on travel. It really democratized travel in a way that I don't think we'll ever see again. You know, it was game-changing, worldwide game-changing aeroplane.
And I'm delighted to say, just before you go, that you've very kindly given us a signed copy of the hardback version of the book, which we'll give away on this programme. Details to follow. But for now, Scott, again, thanks for your time today.
Scott, what an absolute pleasure and privilege to speak to you. Thank you so much for your time. And thank you very much for sharing your stories with us. And I want to wish you the very best of luck with the book. We both do, but you don't need any luck. It's going to be amazing.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it. Great to chat about all sorts of aeroplanes.
Do you know, Jamie, speaking to Scott, just so fantastic, but it made me realise how much I miss the Hercules. I mean, I'm quite lucky here in Canada because they're still flying the C-130, but I know in the UK, just a beloved aircraft, and just hearing Scott speak about it with such affection, I really miss it.
I mean, I've got really fond memories of the Hercules, not least when somebody allowed me to fly one in the Falklands. Somebody put me in the right-hand seat and I flew it for a little bit and did a bit of that. So, yes, I miss it. And it was such a versatile aircraft and a big hoo-ha when it was chopped because it had so many hours left on it and there's so many other Air Forces still using it. But, you know, that's the way it is. But, I mean, it's great that we now have it all written down by somebody who has intimate knowledge of what that baby could do.
I know, and not just the Hercules, 747 as well. I mean, it's with a major carrier. And the other thing I was going to say about Scott is that on his socials, whenever the Northern Lights are out, he takes some brilliant, brilliant photographs over North America and Canada. Anyway, that's just about it for this week. Please join us next week. I've already alluded to this, but we speak to Russ. He served in Iraq and Afghanistan as a door gunner on various helicopters. And trust me, it is an inspiring listen.
And don't forget, if you want to get in touch, suggest a guest or an aircraft, or just want to have a chat about one of the episodes, mavgeeks@bfbs.com is how to do it.
And of course, we are dominating the airwaves with all things Mavs as we bring you Mav Geeks on air to BFBS Radio from 6 o'clock UK time on a Tuesday and 1 o'clock UK time on a Saturday. There is no escape. Resistance is futile.
World domination is our aim. We'll catch you next week. Have a good one.
Ta-ra!